SeaRealm Vault Podcast, episode number 396. Thursday, April 8th, 2021.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. So in this episode, the first segment is the conclusion of my conversation with Dr. Stephen Vinoy. And while we talked about mostly issues related to COVID-19 and the psychology of mask wearing in the main SeaRealm podcast episode, in this one, it's pretty wide ranging and touches on, well, most of my current hot button issues, particularly surveillance capitalism. All right, here we go.
And there's a gym in the basement of the medical center, so I can get to the gym in a minute if I want to. And the gym has closed because of COVID, out of business. And a group of rich guys got together and bought their own insurance policy, and now they have their own private club, you know, in the gym. Huh. So it's not really closed. It's just, it's now reserved for the use of people with money, which seems to be, you know, our society-wide response to COVID-19. Is like, hey, here's a crisis. Don't let it go to waste. Let's have an upward transfer of wealth. What's the justification? Who cares? Where it's danger. People will, you know, they will approve of action, decisive action. And, you know, our lawmakers seemed prepared to take decisive steps, you know, to transfer wealth upward at every opportunity.
Well, yeah, that for sure.
But, you know, I'm just seeing it in my very, very tiny little Bellows Falls existence. Like, I don't have a car. I don't drive. I walk everywhere. I live in a very, very small world. And that larger pattern is, you know, is inscribed very neatly in my little walking existence.
Yeah.
So something that used to be available to anybody who wanted to go use it is now only available to people with money.
Yeah, that's frustrating.
Yeah, it's more than frustrating for me because when I stop working out, my psychological state does bad things.
Yeah, I think 2020 was okay for my meditation practice, but I definitely suffered from the exercise, and I've you know kind of been wondering to myself like what's going on. You know, in 2019 I was hiking and I'd already been out camping numerous times by this time of the spring, and this year, somehow that motivation has just not been strong at all.
Well, I think we've had like 2 days that felt like spring so far. So
there's a little bit of that, but I don't know. I'm walking less, I'm getting out less, and usually the weather doesn't deter me. So some kind of impact. And those are, you know, those are impacts that, as you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, are extremely difficult to quantify. But it's a sense that, you know, if you interviewed 100 people and asked them what have been the effects, what has changed for you, and just ask them to, what has changed for you? Don't ascribe it to whether this is about COVID or not. Just what has changed in your life? I think you'd find a lot of this stuff of people feeling, well, you know, I'm more isolated. I'm not doing the things that I enjoy. It just doesn't feel, you know, the same to because of this sort of restriction that's out there. More hunkered down inside. And certainly there are some healthy options, but it has a toll that's very difficult to quantify.
I think in this conversation, I have been harder on the blue tribe than I have on the red tribe. So I'll say, I think that all of the conspiracy mongering around the vaccines is very unhelpful. And so, you know, if it seems as though my thumb has been on the scale for the red tribe, let me just put it on the scale for the blue tribe in this instance. I'm getting vaccinated as soon as I have an opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think, you know, yeah, the vaccines is like a whole nother conversation, right? Very complicated. I ended up getting it because I'm a licensed healthcare worker in the state. So they called me up and said, hey, want an appointment? And I had been sort of thinking, oh, I'm not going to get that. I'm just going to wait and see. I'm shocked that it was approved so quickly. I'm very skeptical of the amount of money that Big Pharma received to do this. But then when the opportunity came, I went ahead and did it and thought, well, you know, and I think what we're seeing now is this really interesting sense of relief that people are having of like, oh, I got the vaccine, I'm all good. But if you look at the efficacy of the vaccine, it's actually not all that good. You know, 1 in 20 people who've been vaccinated will get it. I have a friend who just was vaccinated with the Moderna vaccine. Kids came home from school with COVID and he got COVID.
I think the advertised benefit of the vaccine isn't that it immunizes you completely from catching it. It's just that your symptoms are less likely to progress to a state where you'd be hospitalized.
Right. People have quickly glommed onto that as some sort of sense of safety. And I hope that's the case. There is some evidence that that's true and that is a good thing. There's just a whole lot of unknowns and we're all just going to have to go into this and hope for the best.
Well, my position on vaccines is informed by a certain cynical streak. I think that there will be reprisals taken out against people who refuse to get the vaccine. Mm-hmm. And I want to be able to travel, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm not fearful of getting COVID. I'm in pretty decent health. I don't have any of the comorbidities that lead to severe, you know, severe case. But I do know that we live in a very punitive society, and it's much more punitive now than it was a decade or two ago, or certainly much more than, you know, when I was growing up, in terms of if you say something that offends people, they instantly start looking for ways to get you fired from your job, you know, which also, given our political system, deprives you of healthcare during a pandemic. I mean, that's, you know, that level of, you know, of hostility and willingness to inflict harm on people, you know, through social ostracizing or, you know, through getting them fired or some other sort of punitive measure that a larger system will inflict on somebody. Like, I was kicked off of Facebook almost 3 years ago now for expressing an opinion which was so mild and so trivial. I mean, it didn't affect anybody's life. It was about Star Trek, but, you know, it got me kicked off of Facebook. And I could have gone crawling back under an assumed name or something, but I just took the opportunity to divorce myself from that whole, you know, psychic magnet.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I have close connections with people who've been kicked off too. And I've been shocked at how little it takes for that to happen. That's pretty alarming. I also don't participate in social media very much at all. And
you're the richer for it.
Yeah, I feel like that. Generally, every time I do, I'm reminded of why I don't. So
there's a social media platform called MeWe, which it's freedom of speech and privacy oriented. So on Facebook, if you make a post, your post has a permalink. There is a URL that anybody could copy and paste into a web browser and look at your post. It's not like that on MeWe. So if somebody isn't friends with you, there's no way somebody who is can share your post with them, except to just, you know, take a screenshot or copy and paste the text or whatever, but there's no handy link. And they don't kick people off for saying the wrong thing. So, you know, a certain amount of people who get kicked off of Facebook and Twitter are ending up on MeWe. And so MeWe is there is a thriving right-wing conspiratorial community there. And I don't participate in it, but I monitor a QAnon research group. And there's very little sense making going on there. There's very little people comparing their points of view to try to see what's consistent and not consistent. They just throw all manner of wild accusations and, you know, and conspiracy theories up on screen, and nobody challenges them. They all just say, oh yeah, and they're just building, but there's no seeming effort whatsoever to find any coherence. It's like they don't care. They don't care if it's inconsistent with itself, you know. Just the more weird, bizarre, and evil the machinations of the powerful are, the better
for themselves.
And I understand the attraction of that, but I just don't see how one can overlook how clearly harmful that is and how, you know, how it can take you to really extreme places, particularly when, you know, we do see people who just go nuts and commit horrific acts. And it's clear that they have been, I don't want to say, you know, induced, but at least they were participating in online forums where these types of, I won't even call them conversations, they're just sort of like snowballing absurdities take place.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the kind of the extreme end of it, which is, you know, maybe kind of the most dangerous in terms of acute events. But I was just talking to Liam about this sort of this issue last night about the difference in what happens in in-person conversations about topics like racism, like the pandemic, like gun control, versus what happens in social media.
Yeah.
And I work in an academic department with anti-racism and white supremacy, and these issues are daily conversations in that place. And they're not happening in person right now, but they are happening real time on Zoom, where I'm communicating with my colleagues, where we have human relationships that are, you know, synchronous, and eventually we'll be in person again. And it's very different than what happens when somebody posts something on social media and you get those asynchronous comments and the miscommunication that happens, the lack of, you know, empathy and perspective taking that occurs when we're communicating that way. And somebody had commented on that original email thread that got us talking to one another now, that they had noticed, even by doing it over email, that there was a different pace to the conversation, yep, a different tone, a deeper connection between the people. It felt like there was more of a conversation happening than people reacting on these platforms like Facebook, where it's not about a conversation.
Yeah. And, you know, most of those people are in Vermont or New Hampshire or Connecticut, and we live in a very sparsely populated part of the country. And there's a high probability that, you know, you will run into some of those people on that email list face to face.
Yes.
You know, whereas there's no possibility really that somebody you offend on Twitter is going to show up at your door.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, even via email, there is that extra caution. There was a funny meme I saw as a video clip of these two dogs barking at each other through a fence, and somebody comes over and opens the gate that's separating them, and they immediately stop barking and they touch noses and they wag their tails, and the person closes the gate again and they go right back to baring their teeth and barking.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're learning more and more about how these social media tools were explicitly and intentionally designed to facilitate those sorts of those interactions, because they do keep people engaged with the platform. You know, outrage is right. Is a mechanism of engagement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can only imagine. I mean, it clearly was very intentionally engineered. I guess the plan was advertisement was going to be the way that they made money, and it turns out that's true. So somebody knew ahead of time that, you know, there was a good chance that was the thing they wanted to optimize. The general public was no idea. It's like, oh, suddenly, you know, my family members are posting baby pictures on this thing called Facebook. And so I'm like, well, I want to see the baby pictures. They're not sending them out by email anymore because, you know, it's more of a pain to do that. So I get a Facebook account so I can see baby pictures of my family members. And then all of a sudden this whole other many things emerge out of the possibilities of that. Fascinating, really.
Well, it sounds like you weren't on social media prior to the emergence of the big players. I was. I used something called LiveJournal for almost a decade before Facebook came around.
Oh, yeah. No, I wasn't.
And the conversations on LiveJournal, I mean, they could get prickly, but they were much more nuanced. They were much more conversational. There was far less deliberately taking people, you know, to say something that they're not saying. I see that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, particularly on Twitter, somebody tries to make a nuanced point and somebody just deliberately mischaracterizes them to make them sound like an extremist from the other tribe. And that didn't happen much on LiveJournal, but you needed to know a little bit of HTML, you know, to indent and embolden certain phrases or things like that. So there was, you know, there was this much of technical hurdle to really expressing yourself with it. And when Facebook came along, LiveJournal just died, just withered on the vine. Everybody, and it's as you say, I mean, your uncle, your cousin, or your grandma, or whatever, can use Facebook. There's no technical expertise required at all. And it's deliberately designed to be easy to use and addictive. And, you know, that's where all the conversations are happening now. So you go over there and, well, they're not the sorts of conversations you were having before on your smaller, you know, your smaller forum that had a mild technical hurdle to cross to get on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess I was using listservs, you know, way back before the internet even existed. And the term flame war existed back then. But those tended to be more sort of closed group kind of interactions where a certain, you know, people with a certain affinity and some kind of like, not just worldwide, but, you know, a group of scientists who are interested in suicide prevention or a group of people who are interested in a particular game, video game of some sort that came together. But it was already apparent this was going to be problematic if you looked that far back, right?
I have very fond memories of listserv conversations though.
Yeah. There's a new one somebody told me about. Is it called Clubhouse?
Where it's for Apple only though. So I'm part of the Windows Android tribe. So
I just understand the idea that the conversations are all synchronous. Like you have to be present to.
Well, it's audio.
Yeah. It's just audio. Oh, okay. All right. So that'll be interesting to see if tweaking some of these knobs might reduce some of the negative impact that social media has, because there are, you know, numerous positive ones as well.
So the New York Times and other outlets have run scare stories about any place where, you know, people are gathering and there isn't a mediator or a gatekeeper to control the conversation. And the one that you just mentioned was, you know, it was high on their list of concerns. They said people are having, what was the phrase they used? Unbridled conversations. Scary stuff.
That is scary. Unbridled conversations.
I just got kicked off of YouTube for a week. They said that I was spreading medical misinformation. Mm. And they never tell you exactly what it is you said that tripped up the algorithm, you know, to get you. And if you appeal the decision, you just get a form letter back saying, yes, we've carefully considered your appeal and we rejected it. And they never tell you, you know, what you said or why. It's all algorithmic. No human has ever looked at it.
Right. I doubt it.
So, you know, we live in a place now where people who make their living on YouTube, I don't, you know, I don't get much money from YouTube, and it's not going to hurt me financially that I'm not on it for a week. But for somebody for whom that's their day job, they have to be very careful about what they say. And so they have internalized, you know, this self-censor. It's always thinking, how could what I'm saying be misinterpreted by a dumb as rocks algorithm that's just looking for keywords? Mm-hmm. How do I change my language to avoid that? And so, you know, here we are more than a year into the pandemic, and you have people who are talking about the pandemic on YouTube who don't mention that that's what they're talking about.
Right.
You know, or they have these weird sort of Mad Lib type replacement words that they use, you know, instead of virus, you'd say lollipop.
Yeah.
You know, but
yeah,
people are walking around in fear of offending an algorithm, which has no sense whatsoever. It doesn't have the sense that a kitten has, you know, that a cockroach has. It has no sense whatsoever. It has no ability to make any sort of, you know, coherent discernments about anything. Mm-hmm. It's just responding to stimuli that it's been programmed to stimulate, you know, to respond to, or that it's been trained to respond to with these huge data sets. But still, it doesn't know anything. And yet it is authorized to dispense punishments, summary punishments.
Yeah. Well, so what do you think? I totally understand this dilemma. And then the flip side of it, though, is like one of the things those algorithms do is keep child porn off the internet. Mm-hmm. And the scale of the task is too large to be done by humans. You know, when you the number of photographs that get posted on the internet daily is, you know, unfathomably large, right? Mm-hmm. So do we, you know, what do we do about it? Isn't that kind of germane to the question of how do we do things that everybody would agree are in the best interests of society, and at what cost for our mistakes?
Well, in the sorts of governments that we tend to consider to be, or the sorts of societies that we consider to be, you know, liberal democracies, the philosophy typically is better to let some guilty people go free than to convict and punish innocent people. Right. And in authoritarian regimes, that's the reverse. Right. Better that 10 innocent people be put to death than have one criminal escape.
Yeah.
And right now we're not talking about putting people to death. We're talking about kicking them off of YouTube, you know, so the stakes are lower, but we're definitely taking the authoritarian position.
Yeah.
Better to deny people who have not said anything dangerous the ability to amplify their voice than, you know, to mistakenly let one bad person say bad things. Mm-hmm. And to me, that seems like a very bad precedent, because going forward, more and more people will be harmed. You know, the harm will be genuine, financial, social, psychological, of being denied the ability to speak in the way everybody else can speak.
Yeah. And I'm recalling now an article, I think it was in the Times not long ago, describing this board or committee that had been put together, I believe by Facebook, to sort of be the arbitrators of how the algorithms get trained, and these questions about what is, you know, what's the balance between, you know, false positives and false negatives, essentially, what you're saying. And it was really definitely scary to think about this very small group of people that, you know, had been hired to spend some small amount of time making very, very big decisions that impact the entire world.
So when you think about algorithms being trained to spot child pornography, well, to train an algorithm to do that, you need a huge labeled data set of things which are explicitly, you know, a human has looked at and determined, yes, this is child pornography. Mm-hmm. So you have people whose job it is to stare at images all day long, and for their whole work day, images are being flashed up in front of them, and they're saying, yes, this is child pornography. No, it's not child pornography. And typically the people who are tasked to do this sorts of work, they're not Americans. They live in much poorer countries, you mm-hmm. know, where the companies who are sponsoring the training of the algorithms, you know, they get more bang for their buck in a poor country.
Right.
So yeah, talk about the harms of, you know, the psychological harms of child pornography. Think about the people who stare at it all day, every day for a paycheck, you know, in order to train an algorithm. There's, you know, Amazon is in the news right now because in Alabama, there's a fulfillment center that, you know, is trying to unionize, or there's been a vote.
Yeah.
And Amazon, they outsource a part of their delivery to these private contractors. So you'll have one contractor who owns a fleet of up to 30 vans. The vans say Amazon.com on the side. The drivers of the vans, you know, they're wearing uniforms that say Amazon.com, but they're not really Amazon employees. They're employees of the contractor. Mm-hmm. And Amazon does it this way so that if any one contractor's employees unionize, so it's only 30 guys, you know, and you just sever your contract with that one contractor, and, you know, those 30 guys who decided they were going to unionize are now unemployed. Mm-hmm. But Amazon has cameras all over the van monitoring, you know, how quickly people are working and making sure they're not goofing off. And they all, and this is the thing that's really driven a lot of the drivers just to, you know, it's made them very angry. There's a camera trained on their face, and there is an algorithm which is monitoring their micro expressions. And if they have a bad attitude as expressed by their micro expressions, then, you know, their evaluation is lowered. And for me, this is, you know, one step above phrenology, really, in terms of its validity. But at the same time, it's really dishonest from the get-go, because they're not really evaluating the driver's performances. What they're doing is collecting massive data sets on facial expressions.
Right.
That's the whole purpose of those cameras. It's not job performance evaluation. It's just data gathering in order to train algorithms.
I'm just continuously amazed at like the way people think and how they take advantage of these opportunities, you know, that nobody would have ever. It's kind of like, who sits around and thinks about this stuff? I'm dumbfounded by it, but it clearly people do. And it's
people
important
to make millions of dollars.
Yeah. Yeah. And they realize that there's a way to do that somehow by doing that kind of thing. I'm just like, you know, I'm really just trying to kind of take care of myself and my friends and my family and have a healthy community. And I just can't think that way.
Yeah. And you know, what do you imagine about the psychology of people who do think that way?
I mean, one explanation of that is psychopathy. You know, people have written about this notion of, you know, we think about psychopaths as serial killers and whatnot, but it's on a spectrum. And there are people, I think one of the leading researchers in this area wrote a book called Snakes in Suits. And was just sort of talking about the prevalence of people in high corporate positions that are really, you know, ruthless and could care less about people and are only focused on making money. But I don't think I think that's definitely a reality. But I think there's a whole lot of people who just, you know, think differently than I do. I mean, even, you know, I'm not an artist. Artists think and experience the world differently than I do, if we can just sort of like artists, you know. And there are a whole bunch of people whose minds work on ways of like, how do I take something small and make it so I can sell it to the entire globe? And that's what they focus on. And in a lot of ways, you know, that's cool, great, fine. But then there are also people who are like, how can we do this that really takes advantage of, you know, maximizes our power? The facial recognition stuff, I have some familiarity with that. I tried to use some of that technology to help see if we could identify if people might have been at risk for suicide by looking at the reactions of their faces and where they pay attention to images on a screen. It seems like an interesting and could be useful technology. But I never spent my time sitting around thinking about how we could use this for public surveillance to constrict people's liberty, but that's the way it's being used. And it's like, oh my God.
You know, I have less of a problem with it being used by law enforcement than I do. Like, for example, I forget the name of the company, but there's a company that owns a great many rental properties across the nation. Mm. And they're using cameras and AI to figure out who's letting somebody sleep on their couch. You know, they know the make and model and the license plate numbers of all the cars of the people who are actually paying rent to live in a certain place. And if you see a car pull up, you know, not you see, but you know, your algorithms and your cameras detect that there's a car that is consistently parking in front of your building and somebody who is not a tenant entering that building and leaving it on a daily basis, you know, here's somebody who's not paying rent, who's who's taking shelter and I'm not getting paid for it. So, you know, then they have algorithms to determine, well, who are they correlated with? Which of my actual paying tenants has some connection, you know, to this interloper?
Right.
Yeah. It's like,
wow. Like,
and this isn't slowing down. You know, for many years, I was talking to people who were convinced that industrial society was going to crash down to a pre-industrial level because of a shortfall of fossil fuel production, known as peak oil. And the people who thought that the collapse was coming soon and it would be, you know, a dramatic collapse, they're sort of known as doomers in, you know, in the parlance of this subculture. And I was doomer for a while. And then eventually I came to realize, no, it's not going to play out that easily. And in some respects, the sudden collapse of industrial civilization would get us out of all of these really weird, bizarre sort of dystopian systems which are growing up around us, you know, constantly being surveilled by cameras and AI, and having these massive data sets combed through and correlated by these inhuman, like superhumanly competent, you know, pattern recognizers, but utterly incompetent meaning makers, you know, which is the AI. They can comb through so much data that, you know, no human being could possibly come close to matching their capabilities. But at the same time, any child who can speak a dozen words is smarter than right. any of these algorithms. And where's that all going? I mean, I've named several examples where it's really creepy right now, but this is just right now. This process is accelerating. And so in some respects, you know, the internet going down and the lights going off because the electricity isn't being generated anymore, that gets us off the hook. We can understand how to live a pre-industrial life, but nobody has ever lived the life that all of us will be living 15, 20 years from now.
That's right. And, you know, you've referred to the algorithms, you know, as unintelligent or simple or crude. But those algorithms are driving cars on the highway.
Better than humans do.
You know, like the potential of those, I think, you know, there's a whole bunch of people sitting around just dedicated to thinking about the potential of what you could do with that kind of sophistication that we haven't even seen yet. But I don't know. You're absolutely right. We can all imagine living in a pre-industrial society and cannot even come close to imagining what we're going to experience in this technological society.
Now, I'm in favor of autonomous vehicles. I just want to be clear about that. Particularly if it's proven that they are safer, you know, if it costs fewer lives to have the algorithms driving the cars, then I want the algorithms driving the cars. But possibly more importantly, you know, most of us who have cars, we're in them 1% of the time. And the rest of the time, they're just parked, doing nothing except taking up expensive real estate. And if you could have a lot fewer cars that are constantly in motion, you know, picking people up and dropping them off reliably enough so that people don't really feel the need to own a car, well, that's a win.
Right.
That's a better situation than we have now. So I'm not any sort of, you know, Luddite or across the board technology is bad kind of guy. I'd like me some technology.
Right. So we'll, you know, we'll see. I'm also on board with that, but I'm just curious now how people will figure out, because I can tell you what, right? It's not going to get used to sell fewer cars. Like I had that same dream too. It's like, oh, you could have this little minibus running around and it would have the optimal algorithm to pick up the most people to deliver the most places in the most efficient way, keep fewer people off the car. I think this is great, but that's not what's going to happen. Or maybe that'll happen, but there'll be some other way that it's being used to continue to feed the capitalist consumer culture that we're all enmeshed in.
Well, it certainly will feed the capitalist consumer culture, but I think there's more and more people who simply cannot afford to drive cars anymore.
Right.
So, you know, but they can't afford $2 for a ride to the store and back.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, the expensive thing about Uber and Lyft and Grab and those, you know, ride-hailing apps is the driver.
Right.
Take the driver out of the equation and you can operate those fleets very economically. Mm-hmm. And when transportation becomes a service rather than an object that you own, a very expensive object.
Yes.
I think Detroit's not going to like it, but here's what's going to happen with Detroit. They've been sitting on their laurels. You know, they've been resting on their laurels. They're just sitting on their hands doing really nothing while companies like Tesla are pushing the envelope in terms of electric vehicle development. But Tesla is like this boutique thing. You know, their cars are very expensive. They're largely sold on image. You know, they're a flex for rich people who are consider themselves to be forward looking. But China is charging hard, developing very low cost electric cars, and brands that you have never heard of today will be all over the streets of Brattleboro 5-10 years from now. And you know, the Detroit executives are going to get on their private jets and they're going to fly to Washington and they're going to go before Congress and say, it's the economic apocalypse unless you give us unlimited amounts of taxpayer money, and they'll get it.
Right.
It's still not going to save them. And it's not going to save the American auto industry.
Yeah.
What Detroit wants. I mean, if all they want is money, they'll get it. The government will just give them unlimited amounts of money, but the government cannot guarantee that they maintain market share.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll be surrounded by Chinese electric vehicles many of them autonomous before long, unless we go to war with China, which I sure hope we don't. Much as I don't like the way they do things, I don't want to go to war with them.
No, no.
I have two sons, aged 20 and 16. So I'm particularly sensitive to, you know, we don't have a draft anymore, but we have an economic draft, and I'm not rich, and I can't insulate my kids from, you know, the need for money.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Hmm. Wait, we've long since strayed from the topic that was supposed to be our focus. And now we're just talking about what a crazy world we live in. Isn't it weird?
Yeah.
Which we can do all day.
Absolutely. But so enjoyed the opportunity to meet you and have this conversation. So is the link to your podcast in your email?
I will send you a link to this episode when it's ready.
Oh, okay, cool.
But my email address is, you know, it's my domain for the podcast. It's crealm.com.
Okay, cool.
All right. Well, Stephen Vannoy, doctor, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
It's been a pleasure talking with you too. Thank you very much. Take care.
That was Dr. Stephen Vannoy. I hope to talk to him again sometime. We obviously have a lot to talk about. All right, next up. Yesterday, I did a live stream and however he packages it these days, I had a conversation with Doug Lane. Went for about an hour. We talked about the HBO documentary series Q, Into the Storm. But we also started off talking about the pandemic and related issues. And because of the way we were talking about it, Doug feared that the whole conversation would be taken down and he'd get booted off YouTube, just like I'm booted off YouTube. So he immediately took down the entire video as soon as the live stream was over. And he's going to cut off the beginning where we talk about COVID and then repost it. So that's pretty much what we're talking about at the beginning of this conversation. So here we go.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can.
This meeting is being recorded. Fuck a duck. All right, I'm on.
It's being recorded, but it's not being broadcast live. And as far as I know, no algorithm has access to it.
Oh, you know what I'm doing right now?
What are you doing?
I've downloaded the conversation we had.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I'm deleting it.
Really?
Because I can edit the downloaded MP4 and put it up again. And so now I'm going to delete the, I mean, it may not, you know.
Oh, I see what you're doing. You're taking it off of YouTube before the algorithm has a chance to comb through it.
Right. But it may not matter.
So imagine this old guy thing I just did. I got told by Zoom that the place on my disk drive where I was storing the Zoom calls was full. So I tried deleting some files and emptying the trash, and that didn't help. So I went to a different computer with a newer hard drive with less stuff on it.
No, that didn't work.
No, that didn't work.
Because a hard drive isn't your hard drive. Is it? It's the hard drive in the cloud that's the problem.
No, I record locally.
Oh, okay. Well, then why didn't work? Why didn't that work?
I don't know. But I have a different computer that's newer and the hard drive isn't full. So I just came over here and...
Okay.
This is my art computer. The one that I was talking to you on before is my podcasting computer.
Okay. So what are we going to talk about for your vault?
We can talk about the anxiety that you just experienced talking to me on a live stream on YouTube just now.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good thing to talk about. I mean, maybe I'm being a little bit hypersensitive, but I don't really think I am. Once we got that warning on the channel, I did a video called The Great Reset. And it was actually critiquing the way that conspiracy theorists think about the reset idea, which has been put out there by like the World Economic Forum and Chase Bank and other big institutions. I just was saying, look, that what they're talking about when they're talking about the Great Reset are a bunch of neoliberal small scale reforms that will have no real teeth to them, that they're dressing up in woke language in order to justify maintaining the status quo for the most part. And the visions, the
Great Reset is we're going to abolish private property, and everybody will get an allowance, and you know, yeah, virtuous, yeah, hardworking behavior and saving will be punished, and licentiousness and laziness will be subsidized. You know, yeah, you know the lingo.
Well, I, that last bit sounds okay to me, but
that's the whole right wing line on socialism. Hey, it's a great system until you run out of other people's money to spend.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, that's not socialism, and it may be redistribution under capitalism. You know, that may be a real critique of redistribution under capitalism, especially if you say something like, as soon as you run, it's great until you run out of profitability or the expansion of the surplus. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't just print. I'm of the opinion that you can't just print money and have people succeed and be wealthy just based on giving them cash that you happen to print. I mean, that's not how the economy works, as far as from my limited understanding.
One exception might be the US dollar, though.
Well, for now.
Yeah, lots of other countries, not lots, but some other countries just use the dollar as their currency, and they would like to have some more dollars. They'll pay for them.
I'm not saying you should never print more money or never introduce more money into the economy. But if your goal is to bring everyone up to a living, a livable wage, say, or a higher standard of living, you're not going to get there by printing money.
No,
that will equalize out, and it'll just be that things cost more and the rich have to have more in order to maintain the level of opulence that they have. And the poor will still be poor, but they'll have more digits in their, in their bank account. But back to the fear I had. So I made this video critiquing the Great Reset, but because I had Alex Jones in there, no one ever told me why. But that video,
when YouTube gives you a strike, they don't tell you what it was about your content that was a problem.
Right. So, but it was, they did say that it was because of medical misinformation around COVID.
Yeah.
They did say that, but they didn't say where that was. And I appealed the decision. The appeal was rejected within 24 hours. I tweeted at YouTube, but the wrong YouTube account, for weeks and weeks and months. I went on a podcast tour to talk about the problem and the problem of YouTube censorship and the problem of big tech censorship. Then finally started tweeting at Team YouTube, or rather than just at YouTube. And in a couple of days, it was cleared up. So I imagine that if I were to get in another community strike warning, which they're not, by the way, you know, in any way compelled to start with a warning. They can start wherever they want. They can just get rid of your channel. They can give you a content strike, a community standards violation strike. They can give you a warning. It's up to them. And we don't know what the criteria is, right? But it has made me very nervous around a couple of issues. One is voter fraud, but even more importantly, the COVID. And I do think there's something to the idea that the state and the corporations together are becoming extremely authoritarian in response to the pandemic. I don't think that the intention of squashing dissent around, say, mask wearing or lockdowns is simply to be able to assert authoritarian control over the population. I think that there's an actual health agenda behind it, but I think it's completely misguided and ideological. And you can see that it's ideological because it's dropped whenever it's convenient. You know, the pandemic was the worst thing ever. Lockdowns were absolutely essential. People who went out and protested or just went out without a mask or went to a restaurant were evil and had to be stopped, until masses of people were out in force to protest the George Floyd murder. And then, because of the ideology of the health institutions and NGOs, that was acceptable because racism was even more deadly than the coronavirus. Getting rid of white supremacy was a health priority. I mean, look, I'm all for getting rid of white supremacy, and I do think racism has terrible health consequences. But the idea that these protests were going to somehow solve, I mean, if they had enough gatherings out in public without, during a pandemic, that was going to solve racism and that was going to have some health consequences? Clearly not, right? So it was, even from its own logic, it was just a matter of some gestures are worth making despite other people's lives. It's sort of the message from the health community, the health experts. But even there, you have to think about how, well, there had been massive rioting like we've never seen in this country before, right before that. So the idea was probably also to vent that frustration into peaceful protests and mass demonstrations in order to subdue it and lower the risk to the nation from more escalating violence and funnel it back into regular politics was probably the goal there. I can speak much more freely here on Zoom than I can on my own channel.
Particularly for the vault. I'm the ultimate authority of what content can be on this platform.
Right. How do you host it when you put it in the vault?
Somebody else built that for me, but it's a Blueberry powered, WordPress site behind the scenes. I don't know a lot about it.
Do you just do audio or do you do video too?
Just audio.
Oh, okay. So this is an audio podcast.
Yeah. So I took the teeth out.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah. There you go. Yeah. Well then fuck. Oh, we're going to relax.
Yeah. Say whatever you want.
I don't make podcasts that aren't video streams as well anymore. It wasn't something I decided either. It just happened over time. I stopped recording audio only podcasts.
How did it just happen?
It just sort of was more convenient to, I started doing live streamed interviews some of the time, and then I started doing them all the time when I would do a podcast interview. And that also meant, you remember back in the Diet Soap days, those original Diet Soap podcasts, I mean, my skills weren't that great maybe, but they were heavily edited.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. They were heavily edited. There would be audio collages in there. I would take out the ums and ahs. I just really went to town on those audio files. And now it's like a live stream that I pop from an MP4 into Audacity, make into an MP3 and release.
You got to get the content out. Quantity.
Oh my God. Boy, it's not like I don't do a lot of editing. Because I put out a collage video.
Yeah, you do a lot of video editing, I know.
Yeah, once a week I try to. And then, whenever someone else gives me a video to put on the channel for like an author does, I'm often, not always, often the guy editing. I just put out interviews with some of the band members in The Long Blondes, which is a UK band from the early 2000s. But also an interview with Gary Numan. Mm-hmm. Remember Gary Numan?
Help me out.
His big hit was a song called Cars from 1979.
Huh. You want to play it? Go ahead.
I'm going to play it. It you can hear it, but through the microphone, hopefully. You'll know it if you can hear it.
I think I already have it in my head.
Is there a way to share the screen?
Yeah.
Okay, hold on 1 second. I'll share the screen.
I recognize it. You don't
need to
see it further, yeah.
Okay. The lyrics are like, I'm in my car and I've closed the door and I've locked all the doors because I feel so safe in my car. That's not really the lyrics, but it's close to that.
Yeah, I know the song now.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, we just interviewed him and, you know, it's a big deal for us to get a pop star from 40 years ago onto the channel. That's so, but I edited that, and that, you know, wasn't just me taking the file and popping it up. I cut in excerpts and from footage of concerts and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, I edit all the time, but the podcast, I think I still get good guests and have good conversations, but the podcasts are not what they were in terms of editing and polish.
Well, for me, I mean, the sacrifice has just been in the regularity of publishing. I don't get them out very often, not the free ones.
Right. Do you think that if you had, that you would be still like, because you were a big, you were a growing concern back in the day. You had a big audience and you were growing and you had a lot of support. Do you think that you gave up on that because it dried up, or you gave up on that because you just got tired of the podcast grind?
Tired of the grind is definitely an aspect of it, but also I kind of rejected the central premise of the show, and that alienated a fair amount of the audience.
Oh, and the central premise was consciousness.
No, I mean, consciousness was early on. That was before the audience. The audience really came with psychedelics and peak oil, were the two things.
Oh, right. Yeah. You rejected both psychedelics and
peak oil? I haven't explicitly rejected psychedelics. I'm just not really interested in talking about it, particularly with people who, you know, that's their thing. That's, you know, the one thing they talk about, the one thing they're known for is psychedelics. It's like, I've said this before. I mean, the audience has heard this, but my current perspective on psychedelics is that it basically just activates a profundity circuit in your head. Like when you're on them, you get into a state where you're feeling the profundity of life, but you're also having these thoughts, and the thoughts can be nonsensical or they can be about stuff that you've read, but whatever, you assign great importance to the stuff you were thinking about while the profundity circuit had been activated. And to try to like to bring that back to your normal straight existence and to try to like reflect on it and restructure it into something coherent, which is meaningful, I think is largely a fool's errand. I think just bathe in the profundity while you're experiencing that, and then talk about something else later. You know,
Robert Wright recently talked about his
stars or whatever.
Yeah. Robert Wright recently talked about his college days on the Wright Show, which is a Blogging Heads podcast. And he experimented with Whippets.
I love nitrous oxide. Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And he said the thing about Whippets was that he got the sense of having discovered a great mystery and something truly profound, but he didn't get any idea to go with it.
Well, that's at least he didn't latch onto some song lyrics or, you know, the text or something.
Right. It just was the profundity. And then there was maybe a sense that there had been some idea, but it was, if there had been, it was gone so quickly within 30 seconds that, but the profundity lingered a little. And he said, this sort of shows that there's a biochemical, you know, explanation for that feeling of profundity that's traced down to, you know, something going on in the brain and that you can play with it. So that religious experience. And so, yeah, that's a very Kurt Vonnegut style observation, you know, that we're all just bags of biochemicals, much like robots wandering around, feeling the things that our chemicals make us feel as we wander through life as fully determined beings.
My
chemicals are making me feel sad.
I'm not opposed to it either.
Yeah, I'm opposed to it, but I don't know if I can overcome it in argument. My chemicals make me opposed to it.
But I'm not determined.
Right, that's right.
My chemicals lead me to freely choose to be determined or something.
My chemicals lead me to reject the way I'm determined by my chemicals. So I can see why you abandoned psychedelics. I also abandoned, like, I sort of started out with that, following your footsteps, a little bit of a psychedelic mystical side to the podcast, but I abandoned that. And I did suffer a loss of audience, but I hadn't built as much of an audience when I did that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got lucky and got some backing. And went on YouTube. Going on YouTube and developing that is what, I don't think the podcast was ever going to get much bigger than it was. It's 3,000 to 4,000 downloads an episode is the top it's ever gotten, really. Mm-hmm. Sometimes a little more, but it's interesting though, because the people who support us for the podcast. I mean, the money we make through Patreon, those people aren't getting more videos. They're getting podcasts and maybe this, like a live stream video, live stream conversation too, but they're getting that in the podcast and a podcast audio version. And that's really all. I mean, if I was better at this, I would give them my time in conversation like we're having right now.
But that's work.
Oh my God, is that work? And you talk to these young guys who think you know things, and then they ask you, have you read this? And you have to say no, no, no all the time. It's, you know, and be exposed over and over again as the emperor with no clothes. And I just don't like it. I like to be behind the curtain. Don't look at the man behind the curtain. Look at the videos.
You know, speaking of your videos and your video that you did in response to Can't Get You Out of My Head, the Adam Curtis documentary.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you were inspired by his style of, you know, taking found footage, archival footage, and cutting it together with music and overlay, you know, a narrative overlay and, mm-hmm. you know, psychedelic graphics and music. And I can really see it. I mean, I hadn't made the connection, but then when I watched your video and then I thought back to all the Adam Curtis documentaries I've watched, it's like, yeah, mm-hmm. that is his formula.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's not like I was only stealing from Adam Curtis. There's also like Gita Board's work.
Mm-hmm.
Which and a whole bunch of the Situationist films, which are all based on found footage, and like Negative Land in the audio world is sort of an influence on me too. And not only like on my, it's not only on my video editing, but even my writing style has a little bit of the chopped up kind of quality to it sometimes. And it, maybe one of the reasons why I haven't been, I never turned into Neil Gaiman is because of that approach to writing. But
have you seen his masterclass?
No.
I'd like to.
I haven't looked.
You have to sign up for a year, and it's $180 for a year. It's like,
that's not bad price. $180
for a year. Not bad price if I take another class beyond that one.
It's not a bad price if you thought that the class was actually going to really serve you well. You know, mm-hmm. $180 is cheap for a year long course. Of course, you don't get any credits. Can't do anything with it except learn.
Yeah, I don't need any credits.
Right. But I'm just saying.
I am not updating my CV. I don't have a LinkedIn account.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not job seeking. In fact, I recently turned down a rather high paid job.
Really? What was it?
It was working for a video game, designing characters. And
because of your comic book that they came to you about that, right?
No, they just found my portfolio on ArtStation, which is, you know, one of a million websites where I put up a few images and then promptly forgot that I had an account. And it was $50 an hour with benefits, but there's no office. It's all remote work.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have time to do the comic. I wouldn't have time to do videos and the podcast and all the goofing off that I do. I would just have to do that one thing. 40 to 50 hours a week, I'd make good money, but I would be in this exact same position where I don't see anybody. It would be the pandemic never ends for KMO.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the upside of doing that is that in 10 to 15 years, you'd be better off when you didn't want to work anymore. Because you'd be the ability to save, maybe. The downside to that is you wouldn't have a life.
Yeah.
But it's not like you have one now, right? So
I was just about to leap when the pandemic locked everything down, and maybe it's for the best, because now I'm thinking instead of Puerto Rico, I'd rather just move to Mexico.
Yeah,
I've been researching quite a bit on the good places to live in Mexico.
I've been thinking about moving to China for a year. Not very seriously, but I've been thinking about it.
I'm pretty certain I will go to my grave never having visited China.
The reason to do it is because everyone on the far left who isn't a leftcom like me or is, you know, some sort of weird Marxist wants to, like, secretly wants to embrace China right now. Like, it's a great socialist model. And I'm just, okay. I can understand. You hate the United States. You like socialism. China was, you know, the last of the really existing communist or socialist countries, sort of, but not really.
No. What support do they provide to their people? I mean, the one thing they do is they generate a lot of useless economic activity to create jobs. You're building cities that, you know, the ghost cities that nobody lives in.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to learn, at least what I've heard is that they have pretty good national health care in China. They don't have
pensions. I mean, that's why the one child policy created, you know, this population of little emperors, because mom and dad, their whole future is on that kid. That kid's got to support, you know, me and you and his spouse's mother and father, because, you know, there's just the one marriage, the one family that's going to have the four grandparents. And, you know, it's nasty. I mean, it's a bribe society. You know, if you're in the hospital, you bring your own toilet paper, you bring all your own stuff because none of it's provided, and you got to bribe the doctor to get any attention.
Yeah, you're right. I just looked up healthcare in China, and it's basically like ours. Public or private.
If you can imagine, it's worse than ours.
Yeah. But I mean, it's a combination of public and private medical institutions and insurance programs. But they say about 95% of the population has at least basic health insurance coverage. But what is basic?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, look, I'm not a fan, but I would go to China in order to be able to learn a lot about it and be able to talk about it with some intelligence rather than an experience, rather than just have a knee-jerk response.
Are you familiar with the 50 Cent?
And also to get away from my maybe soon to be ex-wife. the other reason to do that. I'm not sure how things are going to work out there. So it's like, oh, if we end up not making it, then China, I'll punish myself for a year.
I would consider Mexico.
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 Okay, but I'd be afraid to drink the water.
I've lived in places where you didn't drink the water. It's, you know, it's not a big deal. You learn.
What's the upside to Mexico?
It's a lot cheaper than here. Mm-hmm. The politics aren't as vicious. It's a nice place to live. You know, I mean, there are certain places you want to avoid, of course, but that's certainly true here as well.
Well, could I do the job I have now as easily if I was in Mexico?
Well, your internet connection is going to be the most crucial thing.
Right.
So I think Starlink is going to be, I mean, it's already available in certain
places. What about computer repair or new tech if something goes wrong with what I've got? If I'm in Mexico, would I be able to get that stuff, do you think?
You might pay more, but, you know, you just order it on Amazon like you do where you are. It takes a couple extra days to get there, but that's really the only difference.
Okay. All right. Worth thinking about. Or I could stay where I am and not go crazy. You know, I could like just figure out how to live here still. And that's probably what I'm going to do. Cause
yeah,
I've been here since 91 and not exactly likely to move, but it's something I am toying with.
China and the 50 Cent Army. Are you familiar with the 50 Cent Army?
No, tell me about the 50 Cent Army. I should know.
If you put
this
out
is why I don't do the interaction with the followers, because they ask me questions that I have to say no to.
You have to say no. It's
I don't know anything.
Things that I pay attention to, sorry.
Yeah, anything after 1989, I don't really know. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
If you do a video that is critical of the Chinese Communist Party, you will find that your comments are filled with comments from people you've never heard from before. and they're very angry with you. And anything you say bad about the Chinese Communist Party, they'll say, yeah, but what about? And then they'll say something bad about the US.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, there are people in China who get paid to do that. You know, to right. just go and defend China online. And the urban lore is they got 50 cents per message. So they were the 50 cent army. But there's a lot of people who do it for free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I've been not the victim, certainly by any stretch, but definitely the target, a person of interest to the 50 cent army. And because of that, I just would be very uncomfortable crossing, you know, going through, getting off the plane and going to customs in China.
No, look,
passport and
look, I'm obviously, if I move to China as the editor of a left-wing Marxist imprint out of the UK,
mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a very good chance that if I tried to do that, I would just simply be turned away. Like they wouldn't, I don't, you know, they've been turning out journalists from major Western institutions like Washington Post and New York Times. So would they take a lefty publisher? Maybe if you could convince them that you're going to be their guy,
yeah,
you know, and take some of their money and create some propaganda for them. But if you're going to be there as a critical Marxist who actually is trying to hold China to the standards of their supposed ideology,
they don't want to hear that.
I'm sure that that would not be acceptable. And there's a line, you know, that they use is like, when, you know, oh, white Marxists critiquing China for not being Marxist enough, they should be dismissed as U.S. imperialists or something. So, I probably won't end up doing it. But it's something I in my drastic self-hating moments, have considered doing. So,
but there are places where you can go and live and still have access to the internet and live much more cheaply than you can in Portland, Oregon.
Oh, I'm sure that's true. Yeah. But I do have kids here.
Yeah. But you they're know, mostly grown.
Huh?
They're mostly grown.
They're mostly grown. But I would, well, if I went to China, I'd take my two younger boys with me. Or at least one of the two, the 18-year-old. But I might take them both. And if I were to move somewhere else, I might take them as well. But the China trip would be like a trip. It would be a year-long thing, but it would not be like where I'm moving, right? Mm-hmm. To move somewhere else, I don't know. I mean, I have two kids in Eugene and two boys who are just about to leave the nest. So I don't know. It's not a great time for me to really move.
No, hang out.
Yeah.
But do a YouTube search on digital nomad.
Okay.
I'm going to go close a drape.
Okay.
There's about a 20-minute period in the afternoon where I get direct sunlight on me, no matter which computer I'm sitting at.
Well, it doesn't really matter in terms of picture quality because this is audio, right?
Right. No, it's just annoying to me.
Right. Yeah. Well, I feel like this is a much more personal conversation than I would ever release. Go ahead.
I said, because I'm kicked off of YouTube for a week, I haven't shaved. Normally, I would shave on Wednesday because that's when I go over to the TV station to do a live stream there.
Mm-hmm.
So I take shower, shave, do the hair.
So you have a content strike, content community standard strike on your channel and been kicked off for a week. Is yes. that right?
Yes.
And then you'll be able to come back on. But if you do it again, you could lose the whole channel.
Well, this is my only active strike right now. If they you go by three? The book. Yeah, you're done for good. They destroy your channel after your third strike.
Right.
But as you well, said, they can start with strike three if they want to.
Right. And the content warning seemed to me to be putting me in a place of jeopardy where they could just delete the channel any moment as well if I got another strike. It was like it wasn't a strike. They didn't punish me, but then they would if I did something again, and they did remove the video. And it seemed to me that they throttled my channel for a while, like I wasn't getting the views I had been. But on the other hand, I wasn't putting out the videos that usually get the most views either. So it's, you know, the interview videos don't do nearly as well as the little Adam Curtis style collage videos, which is kind of rewarding to at least when I put it that much effort in, I do get something for it, more views, you know, that's worthwhile. But yeah, I was going to say this conversation has been much more freewheeling and personal than I would ever put up on my own channel.
Maybe 300 people will hear it.
Yeah, no, I don't care. I mean,
and that includes spouses of subscribers, you know, who just happen to be in the room as it's playing.
Right. 300 people, you know, we have, the thing is, like, we have a Patreon, we have about 800 patrons, but mm-hmm. I don't think that all of them are really listening to everything that comes out through the Patreon.
Well, I'm a patron, and I will admit I haven't listened to everything you put out.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, thank you for being a patron. That's very nice of you.
You're a patron.
You should not stop. I believe I am. Let me make sure.
I think there's even a $2 imbalance in my favor.
All right, let me look. Let me double.
Because if you're not, I'm canceling yours right now.
Oh no! Well, don't. let me. Oh, you know what? I'm not at the moment. Let me go and rectify that right now. I'm sorry.
Well, it's all right. I had built up a little credit imbalance because my subscription, you know, it's $7 a month and yours is $5.
Yours is it the C Realm that I should be looking for here, or what is it? What's the Patreon?
What's my Patreon called? It's patreon.com/KMO.
Okay. Okay. Creating comics. Is that no? KMO, creating podcasts, videos, and comics. Here we go. All right. $7 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. It's a little pricey, don't you think? All right, no. Fine.
No, it's a discount.
I've done it. So now I'm not making anything on you. What am I thinking? All right, okay, no, it's good. So now, here's what I'm. By the way, I'm subscribed through the Zero Books Patreon to you. So the problem with this is also that, like, my patrons will see what I support. So what do I support? I support Ben Burgess is one of our authors who started a Patreon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ben Burgess. And I then Isto. Do you remember Isto? Do you ever heard of Isto? Mm-hmm. He's a musician. He does acoustic guitar covers of pop songs, jazz standards. He's fun. And then Blocked and Reported, which is Jesse Singles podcast, which I probably will stop supporting soon. Then Bob and Mickey from Blogging Heads, the Michael Brooks Legacy Project. Used to be, I signed up when it was his Patreon, but he died. And then you. Did you ever, were you ever aware of Michael Brooks? Do you know about him?
I was aware enough of him to have heard about it when he died.
Yeah. He was a co-host on the Majority Report with Sam Cedar, and he had his own show called The Michael Brooks Show. And he wrote a book for us called Against the Web, which was a critique of the intellectual dark web.
Ah.
So yeah. Not against the internet.
Right. But against Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins.
Especially Sam Harris, not yeah, Richard yeah. Dawkins. That's you're going with the old atheists.
So oh, right, right. Intellectual dark web. Who else?
Jordan Peterson, Sam Harris, Joe Rogan,
uh-huh.
Dave Rubin, Ben Shapiro. Those.
I don't know Dave Rubin, and I just have an aversion to Ben Shapiro. I think it's just his personality I don't like.
I don't like him either way. I don't like what he says, and I don't like him.
Don't like what he says, don't like how he says it. That's right. In his damn face while he's talking.
That's right. The intellectual dark web, they were a thing for about 5 minutes in 2017. And he wrote a book critiquing them that did pretty well because it came out and then he died. We have two books that have done really, really well for us because the authors died.
Yep. Mark Fisher.
And Michael Brooks. And it's not my favorite publishing model. I want to let people know if they submit the zero books, there's only a 1 in 10 chance that they will be killed.
You ever listen to the What's Left podcast?
With Amy Therese?
Yeah.
I used to listen to Amy Therese when she was on the Dead Pundit Society with Adam Proctor occasionally. Mm-hmm. And then she had a falling out with Adam Proctor, who's a friend of mine still, I think. I haven't talked to him in a while, but I feel friendly towards him. And I sided with Adam Proctor in that debate, just, you know, instinctually. And then she moved over and did What's Left. And I listened to a little bit of What's Left with Benjamin Studebaker, but I found it, I wasn't overwhelmed. It didn't confirm what I already thought enough for me to continue listening, nor was it interesting and entertaining enough for me to continue listening. But I understand she's gotten pretty big now. I think her Patreon's bigger than ours at the moment. And she is a Twitter queen. She's a Twitter queen after having been kicked off Twitter a couple of times. And the first time she got kicked off Twitter was she said Elizabeth Warren needs to be beaten during the primaries, and that tweet was taken as a threat of violence. I mean, come on, that's an obscene reason to throw. But that's so ridiculous that I'm beyond offended that that happened. I'm beyond outraged that she got kicked off for that. What do you think of Amy Therese?
I enjoyed listening to her. And just as I discovered the What's Left podcast and, you know, thought to check in on it from time to time, that's when she started like putting everything behind the paywall on Patreon. Mm-hmm. With just a little teaser out, you know, on the open internet. And I have not ponied up for the Patreon.
Right. That's an interesting thing that she did that. I wonder, we do two podcasts a week, one for everyone, one behind the paywall. So we don't, yeah. We
that wouldn't. Was my initial model. And then the free one just kind of fell away.
Well, yeah.
It's kind of hard to get any new people to come and pay for the behind the
paywall. Yeah, you know, yeah. You're gonna dry up if you do it that way.
It wasn't, but maybe it wasn't a deliberate decision. It was
You did make a decision, though. I remember talking to you when you made that decision. You said, a friend of mine once told me that only a fool works for free. And I realized how many hours I've spent working to put out a free podcast. And I decided not to do that anymore. But you were pretty burned out at that point.
Yeah. It's funny. I don't remember saying that, but I can believe that I said that.
Yeah, I remember you saying that.
Doesn't remind me of the conversation that I was reporting to you.
Right. Well, maybe I'm misremembering. You know, I've been through a little bit of marriage counseling, though, so I suspect I'm right and you're wrong here. What was I going to say? Oh, but no, this idea of just putting out a teaser and having everything behind the paywall, it makes sense on the surface. I guess if you have a fan base that's really committed to you, that's going to work. You know, if they love you. But I think being loved like that requires being like Amy Therese, where you're equally hated by a group of people, because people hate Amy Therese online, like even more than they hate Glenn Greenwald.
Who hates her?
The left Twitter, yeah. Left Twitter hates Amy Therese. She's a Nas bull.
She's it's a what?
She's red brown, Nas bull, National Bolshevik, you know, the part of the Nazis that were socialists. Right. She's a red brown. She's a crypto fascist. She's the absolute worst. She deserves to be canceled. I don't know if any of that's true. but I'm not a big fan either. And but that's, you know, like I said, I'm friends with Adam Proctor, and I never got swept up in what's left. It didn't appeal to me for whatever reason.
You know, there's the guy, I want to call him a character, but he's a real person, who one of the featured personalities in Can't Get You Out of My Head. He was the Russian Soviet dissident who came to the US and was feted and, you know, was celebrated for a time. But then he broke up with his wife and she went with somebody else and he was broke. You know who I'm talking about?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, I picked up my notebook and I was flipping back a few pages looking to get his name. And then I realized I'm not at my podcasting station. This is the comic book notebook. I can flip through this entire thing and never find that name.
Right, right. Yeah, he went kind of fascistic, that guy.
Yeah, well, he went back to Russia and he started a new political party, which is half Soviet communism, half, you know, explicitly like Nazi socialism. And the flag, you can tell it's a Nazi flag with a hammer and sickle in it instead of a
flag. That's what they're accusing her of being. I mean, I'm not sure, you know, they accuse her of being a Strasserite, which is from the actual, you know, Nazi Germany, and then they accuse her of being Nazbol, which would be a reference to the Russian movement.
Who's the guy though? Who's the Russian that we're talking about and what name?
God damn it. I don't remember. Remember, he had a jet setter model lifestyle. You know, his wife was a beautiful blonde and he was beautiful. And then she left him and he went to shit.
Yep. And wrote a novel.
I look forward to this in my future. Not that I'm so beautiful now, but you know, I will go even crazier in the months to come. Let's see. What's the, Can't Get You Out of My Head, Russian dissident
novelist,
Edward Limonov.
Yes.
Yeah. And he had a book that I actually wanted to read called It's Me, Eddie.
Yeah.
But I couldn't find a copy that wasn't like $200 or that was in an English translation. But you know, so probably deeply misogynistic book.
I put out an initial reaction video to having seen all of Can't Get You Out of My Head. It's just me walking and talking into the cell phone. No notes, no preparation. And one of the things I said about it was, you know, Adam Curtis talks about how modern life by accident and by design is so complex and it sends us so much information that we get paralyzed by it. But at the same time, he's doing this documentary where he's cutting from one person's life to another, telling you things about their lives and not telling you in advance how they're connected. And also, particularly with the Chinese people that he's talking about, he doesn't put their names on screen.
Right. You know?
And so I would stop the video and I would say the name into Google search to try to get the right spelling, and it couldn't figure out what I was looking for. And I would try the Amazon device, the name I will not speak right now, you know, and try to say, you know, how do you spell this person's name? And she would get it wrong. And it was typically Siri that I would get to through the iPad that could decipher the name and render it, you know, in letters so I could write it in my notes and be correct.
Oh, okay.
But my criticism here is of Adam Curtis, who's talking about this information overload and then deliberately adding to it in his viewers.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, well, because he's using the mashup found footage approach, which is fundamentally an impressionistic approach. And it's a problem that I have with the videos I make too, probably, right? I mean, if I wanted people to be able to walk away from my videos really holding on to the argument I made, I would make them a little differently. But I mean, I do want them to be able to think about them. But I also want them to have to watch the video 5 times before they get out. The fact is, I enjoy making the videos that way. And that comes before communication, directly communicating the arguments. If I wanted just to argue, I would write an essay and put it out there. There's something else I'm doing with them, which is just video editing, I guess.
But, people watch.
Yeah. And I enjoy doing it. It takes a long time, but I still enjoy the process. Although I would say that now sometimes a little less. And one of the things that's interesting is that when I feel really good about an edit, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to do well. That the videos I like the most are not always the ones that get the most views. And it's pretty easy to know which ones are going to get the most views. Like the Adam Curtis one surprised me as to, it got like 30,000 views roughly, a little under, but that's pretty good. Our best video's gotten like 500,000. And that was on Zizek and Peterson at the exact right time. Right. But, but the videos I think are really solid. Sometimes we'll get like, we aim at 10,000 as like the minimum, but we fall under like five or something. When we hit 5,000 views on that video like that, I feel really bad. And sometimes those are the ones I've spent the most time on and are most confident in and feel the best about in terms of the argument, and they just sit there. But if I put someone up like Glenn Greenwald or Adam Curtis, or refer to some internet drama, some Twitter beef, or then it gets more clicks. Or if I talk about issues that are hot button issues that make everyone pissed off, I get more clicks. And so there's always a temptation to do that. And I actually, back to Amy Therese, I think that that's a lot of her success, is deciding to break taboos, break left taboos in a certain way, mm-hmm. and generate outrage in order to drive clicks. I think that's what she's doing. When, you know, I do that too to some extent, but I try to do it a little less than, if you're less than the Watkins would do, you know, at the very least, you know, a little less than that, that.
It never occurs to me. I just wouldn't have a clue as to how to, like, deciding in advance which group to piss off and then tailoring to that. I don't.
Well, it's not so much like, it's not like I just say, okay, I'll piss off this group. It's more that I disagree with this group is more how it starts. But I do know like what the argument is. And I do know like that, like, for instance, when I had Glenn Greenwald on, before I had him on, I made a video, a collage video that was defending him. And I knew that left Twitter hated him, and I knew why. I knew the two most current reasons why. One was he said that people gain prestige from becoming trans. Mm-hmm. And the other was because he said that Tucker Carlson was a socialist. if you put it in context, is not as crazy as it sounds, although on the face of it, it's absurd. But he was saying Tucker Carlson has started to embrace redistributist policies that might be associated with a Bernie Sanders style social democratic socialist in some ways. And so
also, you know, he rails on hedge funders and the financial elite.
Yeah. Being anti-elite is not enough to be a socialist.
Yeah. But being specifically anti-financial elite, you know, anti-speculation.
I'm not saying that's
socialist. I'm just saying
that's not enough to be a socialist. It's the combination of that plus the desire to have some social spending and some moderation of like the old Reagan style neoliberal trickle down approach to economics. That's why Greenwald would say Tucker Carlson is a socialist. But from my perspective, of course, that's not socialism at all. And from most people's perspective, you can't be a nationalist. Somewhat, I'm going to say what they would say, a nationalist, white supremacist Republican, and be a socialist. I don't know if Tucker Carlson is a white supremacist.
Supremacy being thrown around as much as
But I will say that Tucker Carlson plays with white identity politics in ways that I think is unhealthy for the country. I don't think that he's helping anybody the way he talks sometimes. But whether he's a white supremacist he's not an ideological white supremacist Nazi, but he is playing with white identity politics in dangerous ways, I would say. So that's why they hated him. But that's why I hate Glenn Greenwald. The transgender thing was specifically about Jude Sadie Doyle, this guy who became a guy like last year and had been a feminist blogger for a decade before or longer, who I had run-ins with back in 2006 on Twitter, you know, who I've hated for a long, long time. And Greenwald said that he was catapulting up the victim ladder in order to use that the privilege that came with it in certain sectors to try to attack Substack, which is another one of these platforms that, you know, Substack. So it was like, she left Substack in a huff and said that Substack was a haven of transphobes. And she cited Jesse Singel and Glenn Greenwald as two of the three. There's another guy who might be a transphobe, whose name I forgot. And
I heard of so that was because it made it onto Rising.
Right. I watched Rising as well. Yeah. So we're both shitlords. Anyhow, so this is why they hated Glenn Greenwald. And I knew that I didn't think those were good reasons. I think that what you can completely think Greenwald's wrong and that he's debasing the term of socialism without thinking he's a fascist for saying what he said, you know, which is what the accusation was around saying that Carlson was a socialist. That's another, like, people heard that as a dog whistles, saying, oh yeah, fascism and socialism are the same thing, is how they read him, right?
Well, they and can then, go together in the most famous example.
What?
I said in the most famous example, they can go together.
Well, one can lead to the other at the very least. Mussolini was a socialist before he was a fascist. But, and there's, you know, it is a troubling history. But the transgender thing, that just seemed like an attack on transgender people who, and a lack of recognition of the real suffering that people who are trans face and go through. And in that case, Greenwald made a point of saying, in almost every context, being trans opens you up to harassment and sometimes even physical violence. So it's not as though he thinks that the life of a transgender person is the life of privilege and power. He doesn't. He just thinks that in some media contexts or in elite academic spaces, you can gain some material advantage by being trans. Which, you know, I wouldn't say that that's even universally the case, but like, it's not, there's probably even trade-offs there, right? But if you're Jude Sadie Doyle, it's clear that there's an advantage to going trans that will help your cred in the woke space. I'm not saying that that's why he did it. I'm not saying that. I don't know what's going on in Jude's mind. I suspect not much, but
I don't really have much of an opinion. I mean, much of a mental image of the person you're talking about. So yeah. I'm laughing with you because you're laughing, but I don't know who it is.
Yeah, right. They shouldn't come for you, but luckily this is going to be in your vault, right?
So, yeah.
And I actually said things that are not that dissimilar to this on the publicly available Glenn Greenwald interview.
I had a trans listener write to me and direct me to an article, 99 Easy Things Cis People Can Do to Help Trans People. And I did a video about it where I basically said, fuck that. 99 easy things. I mean, even if each one of them is easy, that's still 99 things. You want me to make 99 concessions and accommodations to your, you know, your bizarre obsession? Fuck you. And that's pretty much my stance. It's like the most self-absorbed people I've ever known in my whole life were trans people. They can't talk about anything other than their trans identity. They have no other interest. It's like, I have no interest. I mean,
no, I'm backing away. I'm backing away from you now.
Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't say that.
I've lived in New York City, buddy.
I mean, I've hung out with the Burning Man crowd in New York City. I've known plenty of trans people, and they're not very interesting people.
I think it's a bad idea to make big blanket statements about any.
In my experience.
Yeah. Okay. The trans people I've met have been interesting people.
Mm-hmm.
And I've met a number of them, a number of trans men and trans women. And they've all been on relative, you know, certainly as interesting as most cis people I know. Right. But what I will say is that anyone who hands you a list of 99 things to do, simple things to do to help make their life easier, is, you know, high maintenance at the very least, and probably diluted. And I'm going to bring it back to this. Only context in which I might be willing to look at such a list is if my wife turned me over a list, 99 things you can change and to make, fix a marriage. I'd look at that list.
Well, yeah.
Otherwise,
you owe something to your wife. You don't owe something to random people who decided that they're in the wrong body.
Right. Yeah. Right. I just wanted to bring that up again because it's.
Did you follow the whole Gina Carano?
All right. Well, there's a good long podcast for you. There's more with Doug Lane, and I will share that with you quite soon. Stay well.